Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ever since the governor proposed the third grade reading guarantee, spelling out what districts must do when a child tests below grade level in early elementary school, some have wondered, well, what have the schools been doing? The proposal would call for school children to be tested beginning in kindergarten, and when a student was flagged as falling behind, the district would provide extra help. The original proposal required districts to fulfill these obligations without extra funding. Some of that has changed. Joining us now for an update is Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Kathy Kandisky. Welcome back, Kathy.
Thank you.
Question for listeners. Do you think schools should have guarantees? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Kathy, the legislation that has the so-called third grade guarantee in it has been changed. The governor is not happy about it. What's changed and what are his objections?
Well, what the governor had proposed was that students starting in kindergarten get diagnosed, you know, have tests to figure out where they're at with reading, and those that are under grade level or behind get intensive services, tutoring, after-school tutoring, special, you know, tutoring during class, whatever, to try and bring them up to grade level. By the end of the third grade, however, if those students aren't testing at proficient or better on state proficiency tests, proficient's kind of the middle of five categories, I would equate it to a C. If they're not at that level, then they would have to be held back. And that would be the guarantee, I suppose, reading by fourth grade.
Reading, or they'll be held back. There's reading. No guarantee they'll actually learn to read. It's just that they'll guarantee be held back.
Right. They would guarantee be held back but in the third grade if they're not reading at grade level. A lot of people think that that's kind of a critical time for students to be reading, because from there out, if they can't read, they can't, you know, that's what they do to learn. In their other subjects and such, in all their subjects. So that's what the governor had proposed. It was pretty hard line. What the Senate did to it was they made two fairly big exceptions, I would say. One was they lowered the cut score from proficient to limited, which is the lowest of five grades, five benchmarks on the state proficiency test. I would equate it to a failing grade. And then they also wrote an exception under the governor's proposal. There was a exception for special education students and also English second language students. The Senate added another exception for students the principal deemed to be reading okay, basically. They took another assessment and did okay on that, or they did some other work that the principal observed that made he or she feel that they were ready to go on to the fourth grade. And then they also added some funding to pay for those intervention services, which is something that the governor had not done. The administration had suggested that school districts shift existing funds into this effort. The Senate set aside $13 million from Ohio Lottery proceeds for competitive grants districts could seek to pay for programs or tutoring or whatever it was that they wanted to establish to help kids with reading.
As far as special ed goes, are we talking about everyone who has an IED, an individual education, IEP, I mean, an individual education program, or is there more finessed? Do we know?
No, I think there's more finesse to it. I think it's simply special education students. I'm not sure it's all IEP students, but I'm not sure on that, honestly.
In a quote in your story last Wednesday, the governor said that the bill would let principals promote kids even if they're struggling with reading, and also let principals micromanage how struggling readers are helped, among other things. And I didn't get the micromanage reference, because isn't that what the governor wants them to do, is micromanage?
Yeah, I would think. I mean, I think giving the principals the opportunity to exempt kids. Now, you know, just think about this. The governor's sitting in his office saying any third grader who doesn't know how to read should be held back. The principal's at the school talking to the parents about why their son or daughter should be held back. He's in a much more difficult situation, and he's also in a much more firsthand situation where he can see firsthand what that student's doing. You know, some would note, it's true that there's some students that don't test very well, and maybe they can read a lot better than they're showing on the test, and that the teacher and the principal would be in a position to know that and make an exception for that child that others that became familiar with that child's circumstances would maybe think was very appropriate. So those are the kind of things I think that are being discussed. I think it's important to point out, too, the numbers involved here. under the governor's plan this year, there were 17,000 third graders that, if the governor's proposal were in effect, would be held back this year, 17,000. Those are students that scored proficient or below on the state reading test. Under the Senate version, with limited being the cut score, it would apply to only about 8,000 students. So it's a lot fewer students we're talking about what the Senate's doing.
And you're counting the ones that would already be taken out, the English as a second language and special education.
Correct.
Brett in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I was just going to say that I think that there really shouldn't be any what was the term that it was called?
Guarantee.
Guarantee. Yeah, there shouldn't be any guarantees unless the parents are also held accountable. And I was wondering what you might have to say about that. Maybe it kind of sounds like a new way to say no child left behind, but it really should say no parent held unaccountable, in my opinion.
Well, you raise a point that comes up quite often. You know, what the schools or the teachers can only do so much if the parent's not engaged.
If
the parent can't read, if the parent, you know, works and doesn't have time to, you know, spend helping the child as much as others. Those are all certainly huge factors in what that child's likely success is going to be at school. The other side of the argument that I hear is, well, does that mean we give up on that child? And, of course, you can't give up on that child no matter what circumstances they come from.
Thank you, Brett, for the call.
Either. I mean, maybe not give up on the parents either. I know that it's probably a bracketable situation.
What would you do, though? I mean, I know, like, you know, I mean, how do you hold the parents accountable? I mean, what do you require them to do?
If the parents can't read, why not learn to read with the child?
Well, there have been suggestions about the report that came out that everyone cites from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. In their prescriptions at the end of the report, they talked about dual generational education. In other words, teaching the parents as you teach the children.
Yeah.
Like actually making that part of the role of the school district. Brett, thanks for your call.
Absolutely. Take care.
Take care. Also, in the quote that I mentioned earlier from your story last Wednesday, the governor said that that the legislation as it stands now would strip parents of the chance to seek outside reading help for their kids. How so? I don't get that.
That, you know, the governor basically wanted students to be able to go get help wherever, you know, if it worked with the school, if they wanted to go somewhere else to get help, that they would have a lot more options.
And the school district would be paying for it?
That I'm not clear on, Ann.
The legislation, as we mentioned, now includes a $13 million appropriation, apparently for tutoring and other interventions. But let's face it, that's not a lot of money anyways, and although it's $13 million more than the governor proposed. But where it would come from is...
It would come from lottery proceeds.
Which,
as far as I know, are already supposed to be going to schools anyway. So I'm not sure if these are some other lottery proceeds or just they're earmarking a certain segment of the lottery proceeds. Regardless of that, the money would be used for competitive grants. So you would apply, you would be a school district, you'd apply, you would either get it or you wouldn't. It seems just the fact that they're using them for competitive grants implies to me that there wouldn't necessarily be enough to go around to everyone. That some people would win their grants. Otherwise, you would just give it to everyone without having a competitive grant.
And if you're not good at making pitches for grants?
Well, you know, some districts can, of course, hire a person to write their, you know, this is a profession. There's people that write professional grants. So, you know, there might be bigger districts that would have the resources to write their own, you know, hire people to write those, and others that task might fall to someone who has very limited experience. So you kind of wonder how that's going to work out.
My guest is Kathy Kandisky, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter. We're talking about the third grade guarantee. Do you think school districts should guarantee things like this? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Do we know what's happening in other states and whether or not there are any lessons that they can teach us?
Well, during the Senate hearings on this bill, they had some folks in from a nonprofit in Florida who've done very similar type thing there. And they spoke about the success they'd had, and I don't have the actual numbers with me, but essentially they held back, when the first year they put it into effect, they held back a large number of students. might have been, it was higher than the 17,000 that we would have had affected. It was somewhere in the 20,000 plus range, and how that number has gone down in the years since, and how to what they had to say was that it basically got the schools razor focused on this issue. And as a result, they saw success with the student grades on the reading tests. And they also indicated that they've bumped up the cut scores on those tests over the years. So it's gotten harder to meet that benchmark that the students need to meet to move on to the fourth grade. So they spoke very highly of it. But I don't know that that's been the case in every state. And, you know, we should note that Ohio's had a third grade guarantee. This isn't new.
Well, fourth grade.
Fourth grade guarantee. Same thing.
Yeah.
What a reading guarantee for students. But it's never been enforced. And it's interesting to note that I brought some stats about retention rates or promotion rates. Third graders in Ohio last year, 99.4% of them were promoted to the fourth grade. So based on the number that are not reading at grade level, clearly there's students being promoted in Ohio that aren't reading at grade level. And that raises serious concerns about how they're going to do later on.
Did anybody talk about in the legislature when they were debating this, why wait till the third grade? Why not do retention in kindergarten or first grade where the impact maybe isn't so...
Well, that's a good point about the impact of the emotional impact on students that are held
and
back.
And just the learning abilities.
And that definitely was discussed. You know, there's some studies out there that suggest that retaining a student does more harm than good if they're on the bubble, you know, like many of these students would be, if they're close to passing but not quite there yet, that the whole trauma of being held back do more harm than good. As far as why they wait till now, you know, I've heard this saying, and I'd like to say I know exactly what it means, but I really don't. But everyone keeps repeating it, so I'll repeat it too. It's, you know, you learn in kindergarten through third, you learn to read, and then fourth grade and beyond, you read to learn. And I guess that means that that's the mark where once students hit it, if they can't read, they're not going to get much further. I mean, just think of simple things. If you can't read, you can't read your history book. Mm-hmm. You can't take your driver's education test. I mean, just to put it in, probably things that really matter to some students, but there's all kinds of things you just can't do. And for reasons I'm not clear, but anyway, that's a dividing mark when they need students up to level.
Well, people are complicated, and I was wondering, what about other subjects? Because a kid can be struggling to read but be very excited and enthusiastic about things like math or science or something like that. Now, they may be struggling, and to hold them back, what about those other subjects, the things that maybe they get excited about for school and...
like math or just visual things. Or, yeah, certainly I have a son like that. He wasn't that interested in reading, but loved math, you know, when he was younger. So we would have to get really creative with the things that he read. He wasn't going to read a big book like his sister, but, you know, he reads the newspaper, would read other things. So that's a really good point, and that could very well, you know, play into the giving the principals a little more authority here to kind of really look at what the individual student is capable of, because you're very correct in saying, do we really want to hold back someone who maybe isn't quite up to level, grade level in reading, but is off the charts in some other subjects their intelligence in general, but for whatever reason they're not reading. Those are excellent points.
Well, Kathy Kandisky, thanks for joining me and telling me what excellent points I make.
Oh, yeah. I'll come back and do that again sometime.
Kathy Kandisky, Columbus Dispatch, State House reporter. Coming up, we're going to hear from... Another program outside of the school districts that's trying to work with children, high-risk children, on their literacy skills. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the 1% speaks. A former Bain Capital man and Romney supporter says income inequality shows our economy is working. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 60 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today, a high near 70. Mostly cloudy skies for tonight, a low of 52 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 77. Clear skies Tuesday night, a low of 55. And more sunshine with a slight chance of rain on Wednesday, a high near 80.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. Information about how Montgomery & Associates can help you achieve your financial goals is at themontgomerysolution.com.
Go behind the scenes of WOSU with one of our e-newsletters. Find out what our classical 101 hosts are listening to. Get the latest news from the WOSU newsroom. Learn about volunteer opportunities and more. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Governor Kasich has proposed a third-grade reading guarantee spelling out what school districts must do when a child tests below grade level in reading. Today on All Sides, we're looking at supplemental and remedial reading programs already in place. School districts aren't the only entities concerned with literacy. Since 1995, the Children's Defense Fund has partnered with faith institutions, universities, and community organizations to provide summer and after-school enrichment programs around the country. Joining us now to talk about the nonprofit Freedom Schools in Ohio is Laura Young. She's a senior organizer for the Children's Defense Fund Ohio, focused on the Freedom Schools. Laura is also a United Methodist minister. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you, Ann. Very glad to be here.
Also with us is Reverend Dr. Susan Smith. She's senior pastor of Advent United Church of Christ in Columbus, and that will have a Freedom School this summer for at-risk children. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So why don't we talk just generally about what Freedom Schools are, why they're called Freedom Schools, and what they have to do with the issue of literacy?
Well, Freedom Schools actually began in the 60s and the height of the civil rights movement, when civil rights workers, some right from Oxford, Ohio, actually, went down to Mississippi primarily to teach adults how to read, because they had those awful literacy tests and poll taxes and all of that, and people couldn't read. And so they realized that we needed to do something to teach people to read. And while they were doing that work, and they realized that kids couldn't read either. I mean, it was just a deplorable situation. And so Freedom Schools actually began to teach adults to read in order to be able to vote, and then kind of morphed into teaching children. And then there was a lapse in the Freedom Schools for a while, and then it was picked up again by the Children's Defense Fund under the direction of the director, Marion Wright Edelman, later on, like in the 1970s. And the whole point is to get children to read. And there's just, well, you just asked one question. That's it.
The Freedom Schools cite in their literature and on the web and so forth, high quality academic enrichment as just one of the five components. Is there a literacy curriculum for Freedom Schools?
Well, Freedom Schools do not teach the mechanics of reading, but rather inspire children to love reading, to fall in love with reading, to feel like they can make a difference in the world. And the library of books grab the student and bring the student in ways that books in regular school do not. This is a summer program, so it's a summer learning intervention, but not necessarily academically or mechanically. But its parent engagement portion draws the parents in and encourages them, because if children don't receive support at home, it's much more difficult for them to proceed in learning to read.
What if the parents can't read?
Well, I heard your show last Monday, and I think those four strategies that the professor mentioned, one of which is summer learning and absenteeism, the dual generational reading, that is critical. And we encourage parents. It's an intergenerational leadership program. So you've got the children, you've got college students who are actually implementing the curriculum. You've got parents, grandparents, and the community are all welcome at Freedom Schools. It's a very different model. It's actually a pedagogy of the oppressed, you could say, teaching people really that they need to fight for their freedom, and you need to be able to read and be educated in this country if you're going to be free and live up to your God-given potential.
But it's also a program where it teaches children that they really can read, you know, because they come from, home environments are all varied for a number of different reasons, and the schools kind of treat kids, black, brown, poor children, like they can't do anything. So Freedom Schools concentrates on is letting these kids know that, yeah, you can do this. You can. And they do it from a variety of different directions, you know, taking into account different learning styles, just affirming the little children as human beings and making them maybe believe for the first time that they really can. And you know what happens? I think the kids have a part then in going home and teaching mom and dad to read, because now they're excited. Before, there's no basis for them to believe in themselves, but now they can believe in themselves, and they learn to read, and they learn to love to read, and they take it home. So it becomes intergenerational and on a number of different levels. Having those college kids come in to teach them is inspirational, because now these kids say, oh, well, look, there's more to my world than what I've seen every day. And then they have these read aloud guests that come in every day from the community. Oh, and I can probably aspire to do that. And they take all that inspiration and they take it home. And then the parents are required to come to a once a week meetings, and they talk about what's going on. So as I'm looking at it, it's intergenerational on so many different levels. It's just a powerful program.
My guest, Laura Young, a United Methodist minister and senior organizer for the Children's Defense Fund Ohio. She's focused on the Freedom Schools. And also, you just heard Reverend Dr. Susan Smith, senior pastor of Advent United Church of Christ in Columbus, that will have a Freedom School this summer for at-risk children. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I understand, Laura, that you're not teaching, quote unquote, the mechanics. However, what happens when you have a kid cross your path who really needs help with the mechanics, that can't find the joy in reading because they can't break the code?
Well, there are many different styles of learning, and we find that when you invite children into the world of learning and reading, and they see how important it is from the college students who are mentoring them, from the guests from the community, as Dr. Smith was mentioning, who come in and show that learning is cool and it's fun, and that they often go back to school with a whole new attitude. If we don't like to do something, even as adults, how well really do we do it? So we are really teaching children to love it, inviting them into the world of books that they may not have been invited into or felt, as Dr. Smith said, that they are part of. So they're learning to think. They're learning to think critically, and they're learning to ask questions, and there are many different learning styles addressed. We use the Bloom's taxonomy of learning objectives that's been around since the 50s because it works. Teaching the children not just to remember and understand what they're learning, but to apply it and analyze it and evaluate it and create it. And there are many ways to do this through creative learning centers. In the schools, they are invited to look at the pictures, to talk about what might be happening in the book, to talk about vocabulary words that might be in the title. What do you know about segregation? What does that mean to you? How have you experienced that? There are art centers and music centers within each classroom, usually based on the college students' strengths and interests and gifts. So students are invited to learn in many different ways that doesn't necessarily require the mechanics of reading, and no child is asked to read out loud. So they just become part of the community and feel the support, feel they can make a difference, go back in the fall, new students ready to learn.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Yes, you got a wonderful program here, Ann, and
thanks.
The ministers and the people helping these children to read, this is wonderful. Here's my comment. I think it's vitally important that we have a certain standard we're trying to reach at a certain grade level and all that. But I think it'd be first to try to achieve that without making that a standard and see how far we can push them to read ahead by certain grade levels before we decide to make a law saying, or a standard saying, that it has to be done this way or they fail. I think we ought to kind of try it out and use what we learn in science on what can we do here with this situation, and not get ahead of ourselves and run into a stone wall and have a lot of explaining to do why we're not successful in the long run. And I think it's very this is very important, because anybody's having trouble reading, my word, with the standards we have at Ohio State University today, and some of them got A's and are getting their degrees and everything else, and they can't even get a job, a full-time job in the field they went into, and they're top-notch students, and the market's gone.
So you got to be able to read.
Yeah, and those poor souls, what are they going to do? Yeah. I mean, they're going to be left out. You know, that it just bothers me, I'll be honest with you. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Okay. I'll take it on the air then.
Okay. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And not only are they going to be left out, they have a much greater chance of dropping out, and also a chance of going into this cradle-to-prison pipeline. Children's Defense Fund, doing research in Ohio, actually, and nationwide, developed our Cradle to Prison Pipeline campaign, which you can read on our website at childrensdefense.org, but that shows that for Black boys born in 2001, 1 in 3 has a risk of being in prison in their lifetime. 1 in 6 Hispanic boys and 1 in 17 Caucasian boys. This is a national emergency, and it is a shame, and we adults are the ones who need to stand up for children.
And they know by third grade, there's statistics that show which children are likely to end up in the cradle-to-prison pipeline. So what these freedom schools do is they work, I think, on this model of affirmation. I keep going back to that, that you really can. There's this pall over you that says you can't, but we're telling you that you can. The program uses culturally relevant books, which is important for kids, so they can identify themselves. So even if they can't read, there's this curiosity about, you know, what is this in this book? I see something here that reminds me of me. So they might not tell anyone that they can't read it, but they are dying to learn to see what this is about, and it has its own power. I was impressed when we went to the training for the executive directors, and they said, you don't go around and read, you know, every kid read out loud and all that, because that can be embarrassing. The point is not to embarrass. The point is to affirm and to encourage. And so, you know, a kid might go the whole summer without reading out loud if he or she doesn't want to, but they are going to those books, and they are looking, and they are curious. And I think that's the first part of anybody wanting to do something. You know how it is. When you want something yourself, you'll pretty much find a way to do it. If you think you can't, you won't. I remember when my son was in school, and, you know, ADHD, and he's all over the place. You know, he was in Gahanna schools, and, you know, the teachers would say he's not on task, and they didn't expect much out of him. And my ex-husband said, you tell those teachers to expect out of him. And I expected out of him, and he did it. Now, he didn't communicate with me a whole bunch about it, but he did it. And while he might not have sat down and read books that I would have wanted him to read, he was reading other stuff, and he was really trying to find his own way. He's an amazing child. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make these kids understand that they are amazing and they can do the stuff. And when they believe that they can, they begin to be able to do it.
The study that's been cited a lot, that the governor cited when he made his third grade reading guarantee announcement, when he was rolling out his biennial budget update, he cites the Annie E. Casey Foundation's study, and the implication is that it's all about reading, but it's not. It's half of it's about poverty.
It is.
And that's something that's been lost a lot, that and the researcher says that poverty, there's a much higher incidence.
Absolutely.
Of the cradle to prison happening because of poverty rates.
How many kids are sitting in these classes that have toothaches and they can't get them fixed, or they can't see, and they can't get glasses? How many of these kids have parents who are not only poor but very young. You know, when you're older, you have eyes that see differently, and you learn to look at things in terms of your kid's development, and you see that certain things aren't happening. How many kids have parents that are either too young or too poor or both? And so very serious developmental things are going on. Well, you can't learn in environments like that when you have situations like that. And so I think that it's absolutely right. It is so much about poverty.
Well, and here in Ohio, the 16 counties with the lowest proficiency rates all have poverty rates that are higher than the state average here in Ohio. So this is race. This is economics. So the most work for children needs to be done in places where the economy is bad and the expenditures for children are not there.
How do you, who gets to go to the schools? I'm sure that's not an unlimited resource.
Well, we have, ours will have 50 kids, God willing. Now, we already have the applicants. We already have them. They don't have to pay.
How do you, who gets to go, though? Anybody who wants to. So how do you know you're necessarily reaching the kids that need to be there the most?
Well, in our community, we work on the demographics in our community. And if we see that many of the kids from our community are coming, we're pretty, you know, we don't do like an income
There's
tax
no screening.
Check. No.
Okay. Well, okay. All right.
No.
Well, but we've targeted the curriculum since 1995 towards our most vulnerable children. On the west side, for example, we have 4 Freedom Schools started this summer, by the Greater Hilltop Area Shalom Zone. And in the elementary schools where they're taking place, there's well over 90% of children living in poverty. Finding children who need intervention is
not hard,
not difficult, and so many are underserved. And we have these throughout the state. We're having 22 programs. We're going to reach more than 1,200 children this summer, and the great majority of them will experience no summer learning loss. We have a study from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte that shows that 90% of students' summer learning is staunched, and that for 60% of them, their reading proficiency is increased by 1 year. This is a strategy that is critical, not only for keeping children in school, but keeping them out of prison.
Well, let me ask you this. The governor's proposing that if kids aren't making the grade, that the school districts be responsible for summer school and for keeping kids at that elevated level throughout the summer instead of the fall off problem in the fall. What do you think about that, Susan Smith?
Well, I think the school systems have a lot on their plates. I am not sure that because I think And I don't know. I'm not in the school system, but I know that there's...
But you're a taxpayer.
I am a taxpayer, and I think that there are prescribed things that public schools do that are not necessarily very good for children. I think that, and this is just my opinion, but I think that so many people in high places, legislatures, school boards and stuff, look at children, especially poor and black children and brown children, as objects and not subjects. In other words, they look at them as almost as banes of the society. Little objects who will take away. And I've read reports, I read Jonathan Colzall's stuff, and how legislators will say, well, throwing money at these schools is not going to help the problem, when these same legislators will throw money at the very wealthy schools. So there's a disconnect in terms of, and they say throwing money at these poorer schools is not going to help these children read. So they're not looking at these children as subjects, as children who have very different predicaments and situations in their lives. They're not looking at that. And so if you say that the public schools ought to do it, yeah, that would be a good thing. But I would think, Anne, that there would have to be like a whole reorientation of not only but teachers and legislators and all kinds of people. So we can see different people as they are and not through the same lens. I mean, I always joke around and I always say that, you know, men have no idea what it is to be a woman on a period. They have no idea. So they look at as many of us, and if we're on our period and, you know, we got cramps, they don't get it. Let a man go through a period one time, or let a man have a baby, and then, oh my gosh, things would very much change. And that's the same way. If people could live for one day or 1 week in the life of a child who is poor, you know, who has not the same access to things that middle class or wealthier kids have, I think that the situation would change. How likely that is to happen is not very likely.
So in the meantime, the Freedom Schools go up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Reverend Dr. Susan Smith, Senior Pastor of Advent United Church of Christ in Columbus. They'll have their own Freedom School this summer for at-risk children. Also, Laura Young. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thank you very much.
Laura Young, she's a United Methodist minister and senior organizer for the Children's Defense Fund Ohio, focused on the Freedom Schools. Coming up, we're going to hear from a curriculum director from Licking Heights Schools who will tell us just exactly how they do put the curriculum together for reading. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, why we're getting fat. One-third of Americans are obese, another third are overweight. Kelly Brownell explains why changes in eating habits and our sedentary lifestyles pose serious threats to adults and children. He's one of the experts featured in a new HBO documentary series about obesity called The Weight of a Nation. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 61 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today, a high near 70. Cloudy skies for tonight, a low of 52 degrees. More sunshine for Tuesday, a nice day with a high of 77. Clear skies Tuesday night, a low of 55.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to support WOSU. More on leaving a legacy at 292-9678.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Governor Kasich has proposed a third-grade reading guarantee. It spells out what school districts must do when a child tests below grade level. So what are public schools already doing for children who fall behind in reading in those early elementary grades, K through third grade? We invited several districts to join our conversation. Only one took us up on it. One always does. Joining us now is Susan McLaughlin. She is Director of Curriculum and Instruction for the Licking Heights Local School District. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Some folks have questioned the need for the third grade guarantee, at least components of it. They say that districts already are evaluating children every year and giving them every opportunity the district can already afford. Do you think that Licking Heights falls into that category? In other words, is reading at the top of the food, of the curriculum diet?
Yes, absolutely. I think that reading and math are both a large focus, particularly because of the upcoming Common Core standards that Ohio has adopted and that school districts are slowly implementing grade by grade, which we are in kindergarten through third grade very quickly. Kindergarten and first grade have already moved to the Common Core standards. Second and third are folding in and so on. So the literacy is extremely important, and we know that literacy encompasses all types of reading. One of the areas that many children struggle with is informational reading and reading, you know, nonfiction type text, which is heavy in the Common Core now. So we've got to do things to help our students read informational text in a better way. And we do that. We've got a lot of systems and supports in place to help kids of all, you know, socioeconomic backgrounds, all race, everything, to read at grade level.
And you're testing them from kindergarten, mm-hmm. then again in first grade, then again in second mm-hmm. grade, so you know who these kids are mm-hmm. already. Mm-hmm. So when the district looks at them and they've got their 20 or 30 or 100 mm-hmm. kids that are not mm-hmm. making the grade, what do you do? Do you just go, oh, well, better luck next year?
No.
Okay.
We have a lot of assessments that we put in place. Many are informal type assessments that teachers will do in the classroom. Some are, you know, benchmark assessments that are normed and referenced and whatnot. And so we use sort of a combination of those things to find out which kids are struggling. Then we take those kids and we start early. So, for instance, one of the programs that we have in Licking Heights that many, many, many school districts across the country use is called Reading Recovery. So we take those first graders out of their classroom for an intense half hour one-on-one reading instruction with a specially trained reading recovery teacher. And they go anywhere from 12 to 20 weeks. And it is very intense. And the hope is that by the end of the 20 weeks, that the student will have caught up and be reading at grade level.
One of the things about reading recovery is teachers literally go through word by word as the student reads the text. Mm-hmm. They mark every word.
Mm-hmm. That's a running record, yes.
But it's expensive.
It is expensive, but one of the best things that I'm really excited about is that Reading Recovery and the Literacy Collaborative Program at Ohio State, they have a large I-3 grant, which stands for Investing in Innovation. And that I-3 grant is allowing us to send teachers to reading recovery training for free that's covered by the grant. So we're currently in the process of figuring that out and who's going to go to reading recovery training next year and so on. So we get more teachers trained. And what I would like to do is have more classroom teachers trained in the skills of reading recovery as well, because any type of professional development you can give to teachers to help them with reading in the classroom is spectacular.
Another component of reading recovery is bringing the parents in on it and teaching the parents how to work with the kids at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is very important. And the previous guests you had, you know, everyone had talked about how important it is to have parents as a part of the reading process and the learning process as a whole. And it is. And we know that it's difficult to bring parents in all of the time. And reading recovery does do that. We've done several things. Even my son's school did this last week, was, you know, a reading night where parents come in. Many times we've done them where the teachers are teaching the parents how to read with kids at home. So we have things in place that we do to bring parents in. Reading Recovery does ask parents to come in and watch the reading recovery sessions, and it's an, you know, a whole education of the whole family at the same time.
We have a message from Brian on Facebook. He writes, while it seems anecdotal to reference my own experience, I was very misbehaved, inattentive, class clown, and an all-around pain. It would seem unfair to hold my teachers responsible for my grades or to guarantee my outcome, especially in the third grade. So thank you, Brian, for that. I'm wondering, what about those kids? I mean, how do you guarantee something like that?
You know, that's the thing, too, because the word guarantee is difficult because we know that reading is not a linear process. Kids are moving in and out of reading skills constantly. They grow at different rates. So, you know, we've got processes in place. One of the things that we use is called response to intervention, or RTI. It's kind of like a intervention team that meets together to work with teachers and parents and kids, like he was, you know, talking about being, you know, sort of crazy in the classroom. We want to make sure that those kids don't have, you know, other things going on, family issues, you know, medical issues, whatever. And then we're looking at providing an engaging classroom experience for these kids where the teachers are highly trained. We've got, you know, good reading instruction going on that the kids like. And there's a lot of research behind choice, especially as you get into second, third, fourth, and higher grades, that the children being able to choose what they want to read at the appropriate reading level is extremely important. So when I was in school and we're all reading from the same reading book, we knew that that wasn't always the best way to teach reading because it's not meeting individual students' needs.
What is Licking Heights not doing that they would have to do if this third grade reading guarantee went through as the governor proposed?
I think one of the things that you know we're constantly hearing about is this summer reading intervention. We have already a summer reading program for students, but the prescription that he's sort of put out there seems very limiting. And
he calls it summer school.
Yes. And that is something that is expensive. You know, we've got to bring in our teachers. We've got to potentially provide transportation for the students if it is truly going to be a summer school. And if we want to reach the kids that are our lowest readers, we need to provide the transportation and lunch and breakfast and those things so that they can get there. So that's a big one that concerns me, is how do we pay for that? And I understand the grant process that he has talked about. And the previous guest said, too, you know, you've got to apply for those grants. It's not a given.
So that's troubling.
And it may have nothing to do with a need necessarily.
Exactly.
My guest is Susan McLaughlin. She's Director of Curriculum and Instruction for the Licking Heights Local School District. We're talking about the third grade guarantee or the proposed third grade guarantee. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is the process that Licking Heights goes through to decide when and if a child should be held back?
It's a lengthy process, and it's one that we don't make lightly. We're looking at what kinds of interventions have already been put in place. Has the student gone through the RTI process? What are the scores on their reading benchmark assessments? What kinds of things can we tell from those reading assessments that we can, do instructionally? Are there, again, medical issues? Are there absentee issues? So we take sort of this whole picture of the child and evaluate that with administrators and the teacher and support staff before we would even consider retaining a child. And it's not to say it's never done. There are kids that are retained, but it's not something that we want to do. We want good, strong instruction. We want good interventions in place, supports for the kid, and we will do many, many things before we'll consider retaining a student.
So what is the tipping point? Should it be a grade?
That's hard because I also come at this from a teacher point of view because I was a teacher for many years before I did this. And I'm thinking back to students of mine that maybe should have been retained, maybe not. One thing that sort of comes through my mind several times is the idea of a very young, immature student. Some kids start school early, and maybe that's the tipping point. They need another year of developmental growth in the classroom and with their peers to master the concepts in the next grade level.
A lot of people are working on choreographing when their kids start school. Mm-hmm. It's really important to them. They do it for sports.
Mm-hmm.
They do it for a lot of reasons. How much does the district get involved in that?
We do to some extent. We've got the typical, birthday cutoff. We want kids to start school when they're developmentally and socially ready. And one of the things that we are just starting, which is going to help us tremendously, is we're starting a preschool program in Licking Heights, full day preschool that is in conjunction with the YMCA of Licking County and our own special ed department. So there are sort of two parts to it. There's a preschool program that the Y will do, and then we've got our special needs preschool that has, spots for typical peers in it. And all of that preschool will be put under the same curriculum. And we've, researched curricula to use for kids that age. And what we're hoping is that by bringing that preschool in-house, we will then be able to catch these kids even earlier. And there's a lot of research, even in the Annie A. Casey Foundation report, that says that pre-K and kindergarten intervention is extremely important.
Martha in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Martha.
Hi, thanks. I just had a question about how these kind of guarantees for the kids who need a lot of intervention affects sort of the middle-of-the-road kids and also gifted kids who need a lot of challenges and have that potential for getting really bored in school and sort of disengaging.
One of the things that we do as educators is it's extremely important to differentiate our instruction and at the same time constantly assessing students to find out where they are. So, for an example, a classroom teacher may have a wide variety of students, everything from kids who are struggling to perform at grade level to these middle kids that you're speaking about to, highly cognitively gifted students. And so what we're doing is we're looking at ways that we can teach to all different groups of students. So we may teach a lesson and then do some kind of very quick assessment to figure out which kids mastered the content, which kids need some more help with the content, and which kids have, gone above and beyond. And then we're looking at, in the next day or the next week, how do we put lessons together that are engaging for all different types of kids? And it's a hard job. It's very difficult. And one of the things that we do is collaborate. Teachers are constantly collaborating and many times for hours after school so that they can do this type of work with their kids.
That just sounds like a huge challenge.
It is.
That's good work.
Thanks.
Thanks, Martha.
Thanks.
Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi. Just a quick question for your guest. Kind of seems to me like this is more of a carrot and or stick without carrot approach. And I just wanted to find out her opinion if she feels like it's more the same, you know. So I'll take my comment off the air.
All right, Beth. Thank you.
Okay.
You know, we know, I mean, there has been a guarantee for a while. And the, one of the previous guests talked about the fourth grade guarantee. And I was in the classroom teaching when the fourth grade guarantee was around. And I think the sort of fix to all of it is looking at instruction. We've got to look at instruction to make sure the standards are being taught. We're looking to see if kids are growing in their classroom with their teacher. We're making sure we have the best teachers that we can possibly get. And there is some element of, you know, this is the same thing over and over again, but as long as I can remember, being the best teacher in the classroom and having a highly trained teacher that is constantly developing professionally and having a consistent curriculum that is standards-based and looks at data to drive instruction, that has always been the key to making sure that kids work or kids learn and that the system works.
What about the impact of holding a kid back? What extent is that assessed in terms of the psychological impact and that sort of thing?
I mean, it certainly is taken into account. We don't want an eighth grader that's 16. I mean, that's not appropriate. We are going to look at, with our psychologists, we're going to look at that whole child and see, is it a case where, you know, a student needs to be held back because of their social or emotional growth?
Do parents When you're at that point in the tipping point, do parents tend to be, or I don't want to generalize, but how do parents react to that? Do they tend to be supportive and like, oh, thank God you're going to do something about this? Or are they resistant?
You know,
even at those early ages?
It seems like the earlier ages, in my own teaching experience, the earlier ages, there's not as much resistance. It's when you get older and kids are more social beings and more in tune with social groups and peer groups and whatnot, that it's much more difficult to retain a student. But I think the key, though, is constantly communicating with a parent. And as long as we're working with parents all the time and communicating constantly about their student's progress, you know, if we absolutely have to retain a student, it's better when we've had a lot of working with the parents.
What about teachers who take on classes for 2 years in a row?
Oh, like looping?
Yeah.
I actually did that one of the years I was teaching.
Does that help in some cases?
You know, I liked looping a lot.
Because then there's not the stigma.
Yes, that and... Oh, wait.
And then they're also with the same teacher.
Yes, that's true. Having the students stay with the same teacher. You know, I've done that before, and I like having the same child again because I'm starting off in the gate, boom, I know exactly where they are, exactly where they're going, and so it's a good one for me.
Well, Susan McLaughlin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It
was a pleasure.
Susan McLaughlin, she's Director of Curriculum and Instruction for the Licking Heights Local School District. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.